move to the third case this morning, Tax Track System versus New Investor. Mr. O'Leary. Oh, Mr. Connolly. Sorry.
Thank you.
May I pronounce it Connolly?
Connolly? Right.
In our family, we pronounce it Connolly, Your Honor.
All right. Third time's a charm.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Kevin Connolly. On behalf of Appellant Tax Track Systems, we present this consolidated appeal seeking reversal of two judgments entered by the District Court below. The first judgment was based on a summary judgment dismissing both the appellant's claims and the appellee's counterclaims. Second, we seek reversal of a subsequent order based on the summary judgment by which the District Court entered an award of attorney's fees, finding that the appellee, New Investor World, or NIW, was the prevailing party. Summary judgment should be reversed in this case because the District Court, drawing inferences against TaxTrack, found that there was a failure by TaxTrack to maintain confidentiality of documents that were shared in a confidentiality agreement with NIW, which NIW summarily terminated after 4 months.
Mr. Connolly, I wonder if you could begin by clarifying exactly what TaxTrack regards as the protected information, because it seemed to me it might be the business method, if you will. It might be some memo, but it will help me think about what you protected or not once I know what it is you think you were protecting.
Fair enough. Thank you. First of all, what was characterized by the District Court and also by NIW was the whole world of leveraged life insurance. TaxTrack was not claiming that the concept of leveraging premiums on a life insurance payment was something that it and it only could practice or had practiced.
Which would have been impossible given the New Investor article.
Well, it would have. It just wasn't consistent. And in fact, TaxTrack never claimed that it alone could practice leveraged life. So shrinking that down that universe, okay, what we did claim under the confidentiality agreement were both proprietary information and the specific confidential information that's listed in the record at A35 as Exhibit A, or sorry, Schedule A to the agreement.
But I guess I'm not sure whether this fully answers my question. I mean, I've looked at Schedule A, which is a kind of a bare-bones statement here, and I can understand the opinion letters probably refer to something specific. I don't know what the variable loan crawl-out software is, but I'll assume that's something specific. But I understood from your brief that one of the things you were trying to protect maybe wasn't the whole universe of leveraged life, but it was somehow the combination of leveraged life with the bank loans, with the promise to roll the interest back in, and, you know, kind of all of the details. But I don't know whether that conceptual framework is something you're trying to protect, or whether it's really just this GCT memo that you say is your confidential information.
Right. And it's not just the GCT memo. It is TaxTrack's relationships with the lenders with whom it had already accomplished these kinds of leverage lives. It's TaxTrack's relationships with insurance companies who had written the riders in partnership with TaxTrack that allow for these kinds of leverage life insurance policies. So it's not, TaxTrack wasn't trying to lasso some whole big concept and say that everyone, that what everyone else is doing, it owned. It was trying to say what it had been doing and what it was disclosing to NIW under this confidentiality agreement was proprietary.
Well, what evidence is there in this record that the relationships with the lenders or the other insurance companies was something ever even conveyed to NIW?
Well, there's the fact that Mr. Gray, who's the principal of TaxTrack, had already done business with Prudential Life Insurance, for example, and knew the internal contacts there for who would submit and who would affirm or approve these kinds of leveraged life policies.
No one ever did, actually, right? So maybe do you mean to say who might have approved?
Well, no one ever did in the 4 months before NIW terminated the contract. Mr. Gray and TaxTrack had done these kinds of deals in the past. But then I'm talking now about what had been disclosed to NIW. Within months, in fact, within the 90-day termination period after April of 2001, NIW went off and sought a relationship with Prudential at a time when Prudential had itself a confidentiality obligation to TaxTrack. So there is evidence that it goes beyond the GCT memo that was the focus of the district court's summary judgment order. Now, granted, there are concepts and there are proprietary concepts. What we claim is that TaxTrack had proprietary concepts that were disclosed to NIW that NIW didn't have before. In fact, it was only incorporated in the fall of 2000, months before NIW entered into the confidentiality agreement. The NIW principals indicated that they hadn't been practicing any sort of leveraged life programs or policies for their clients before they met Mr. Gray and before they entered into the contract.
But that in itself you can't be objecting to if, as you started out by saying, there's no protection anyway for the concept of leveraged life. There are these magazine articles. The industry knew about this. So just because they hadn't been doing it doesn't mean that you had the right to prevent them from doing it.
We didn't have the right to prevent them from doing it beforehand, obviously.
Well, why would you afterwards if it's in the public domain?
And that brings up a good point, Your Honor. I want to make sure it's clear. NIW in its appeal brief makes the point that we somehow were trying to convert this into a non-competition provision that would live beyond the contract. And we're not. The non-competition provision in the contract existed for its term. However, within its term, in the 90 days after NIW gave its notice of termination, NIW was off seeking lender relationships and preparing competing marketing documents, such as the executive summary, that included TaxTrack's plagiarized information. So,
but if this memo, if 600 or 700 copies of this memo were floating around, even if NIW got hold of it, there's maybe it was plagiarized in the sense of copied. But if there's no copyright protection, it's all out in the public domain. People can copy. They can use the word elegant, you know, in their text, even though you used it too. I mean, in other words, you still have to get back to why is this protected? What exactly is protected, and why could they not use what? If assuming that your little chart is right and they really did copy every word, you know, why couldn't they?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the two cases that are most illustrative of why they can't, the first being Rockwell, which both sides discussed extensively in their briefs, but another case, Goldberg, also from this circuit, although I will point out that they were applying Minnesota law in Goldberg, but both cases are consistently of the mind that if a defendant wants to claim that something they took and they have to acknowledge they got from the plaintiff is in the public domain, they have to show they went and got it from the public domain and not from the plaintiff itself. And in Goldberg, I think that point was made very clearly. The court said...
Before you get into a discussion of the cases, I'm still stuck at the very threshold question that's been asked a couple of different ways thus far, which is, what exactly are you claiming is protected by this agreement? So far, you've mentioned relationships and concepts, and I'm having a hard time seeing how either of those things fits on the list that appears on Schedule A of the confidentiality agreement, which is apparently the universe of information that is protected by the agreement.
I didn't
so
mean
maybe
to,
you can link all that up.
I didn't mean to jump past the information or the documents to the concepts, but the concept as TaxTrack practices it of leveraged life is contained in the variable loan crawlout software. It's contained in the leverage overview memorandum. It's contained in the CMS analysis.
Did you ever give NIW the whatever the leverage overview memorandum is?
Yes. Mr. Gray has testified that he gave it to Grace Kruger, one of the NIW principals, in 2001.
Is it a memo that says at the top leverage overview, or is it this LOM/GCT that you're talking about in your brief?
Yes, Your Honor. They've gone by different titles, but they contain the same text. One is called Leveraged Overview Memorandum, and the other one is called Gift Compression Techniques.
But these are one and the same?
With slight variations over time. They've been modified, and as Mr. Gray, I think, testified in the record according to changes in the tax code, but they are essentially the same, yes. So NIW admits receiving the Skadden ARPs and more, well, at least the one or more of the tax opinions that support and tax tracks leverage life overview. They admit receiving, well, they don't admit it, they dispute receiving the gift compression techniques memo, but given the summary we've provided to the court and to the district court at pages 5 and 6 of our reply brief, it's not just coincidence, it's plagiarism. And they haven't told the court and the district court below what other legal source they got that document from.
Well, is this material that you're referencing included in this so-called GCT memo that was distributed on a widespread basis without confidentiality agreements?
The GCT memo was admittedly distributed to some people under circumstances without a specific confidentiality agreement. And
under many circumstances.
Well,
most, actually.
Well, I think in the record there were 190 confidentiality agreements, and the district court...
Did the math.
More than half. That's true.
Right.
But taking it from another angle, Your Honor, NIW, if there were 400 floating around, never said to the district court and never put in the record, well, what Brian Jones used to write our executive summary after we terminated the tax track agreement, what we used to create our own marketing documents came from sources B, C, D, E, and F. They never said that. They couldn't refute that it came from what they learned from TaxTrack. And that's why the Goldberg case, I think, and the Rockwell case are instructive. Because the defendant can't just say, gee, I don't think that the plaintiff did enough, and I can show that there were lapses in what the plaintiff did to protect their confidential information, and therefore I'm off the hook because I could have gotten it somewhere else.
But, you know, there's a big difference between these memos and what was going on in the Rockwell case. If something is entirely in the public domain, I'm not sure that there really is a necessity to show that you got it from A versus B. Rockwell, there were a lot of efforts to keep those drawings and the like, the piece designs, secret.
And Judge Posner recognized the tension and the cost-benefit that a company has to go through,
right,
depending on its resources.
But there was nothing like that going on here. Mr. Gray himself testified that he gave hundreds of these things out without any kind of effort to keep them confidential.
Well, I would respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor. Mr. Gray gave them out. Mr. Gray's almost a sole proprietor. There's a limited number of resources he has. He is not Rockwell. He didn't have a vault.
All he has to do is stamp confidential at the top of the page or something. I mean, it's the point is, if he gave all of these things out, it's really different from the efforts of the company in Rockwell was exerting to keep its information confidential.
But if we compare it on Rockwell's on one part of the spectrum. A case that NIW cites in their brief, the Way case, where someone thought they had 31 trade secrets about how to operate and make money in the wheat or whey market, and they entered into a joint venture with another company and never required any confidentiality of their joint venturer, and they never required any confidentiality of any of the people that they gave these 31 secrets or facts to. Here, Mr. Gray and TaxTrack did at times require certain people to enter into confidentiality agreements, including the defendant appellee, and including others such as Prudential or a co-producer in the insurance market such as David Green. So he had to pick and choose, when it was that confidentiality agreements are appropriate or not. If someone's not a threat to him, if someone is a potential insured who's going to say, gee, I don't think I'm interested in this, then perhaps it's not, given the cost and benefit of his particular business, appropriate to demand one. I would like to address whatever questions the court has on attorney's fees, either now or in rebuttal as well.
You don't have much time.
Very good. On the attorney's fees issue, first, the district court made three errors. By refusing to defer any consideration of the attorney's fees until after this appeal, the district court essentially jumped the gun. Because we contend that summary judgment should be reversed in the case remanded so that TaxTrack can proceed on its claims, the attorney's fees was prematurely decided. Second, the district court accepted NIW's characterization as of their $1.3 million counterclaim as merely defensive, and then said that it wasn't the weighty part of the case or that it didn't take up the most time. If the court looks at, as I'm sure it has, the district court record and the order itself, a fair amount of time was given to both issues by the parties and by the court. And finally, and I can address this in rebuttal as well, the court applied the rule of who is a prevailing party to TaxTrack rather than to NIW as the move-in. Thank you.
Well, your time has expired. I'll give you a minute for rebuttal when you come back. You can have a minute for rebuttal.
May I please the court, counsel? My name is Dan Noland. I represent the New Investor World, Inc. Your Honors, I'd like to begin with where you started with respect to the protectable interest. The key is the license, the Schedule A to the confidentiality agreement. That is the only thing that would potentially be license material. TaxTrack has attempted to prevent NIW from marketing the entire concept. And I do disagree with counsel with respect to what TaxTrack has tried to prevent NIW from doing. In Mr. Gray, who is their principal's position, and his testimony before Judge Gettleman, which was page 67 of the February 5th, 2001 transcript, he was asked the question whether or not one of the unique elements about the premium financed life insurance generally is that you can finance the premium. And Mr. Gray responded, correct. So it is a bit of a different position here today. And we've had the same problem throughout about what exactly is protectable, and I don't believe we've heard it even till now. The potential of protection of the lenders and of the relationships with the lenders or relationships with the insurers is completely unsupported by any of the language of the agreement or anything else in this case. There's no mention in the agreement in Schedule A about any protection of any relationship with any lender or insurer.
Could I ask you, Mr. Noland, about this leverage overview memorandum? Because if I'm understanding anyway what Mr. Keneally is saying, it's that some of these more detailed levels of protection might be contained within these memos, but reading your brief, I was under the impression that you're not sure whether you ever actually got the leverage overview memorandum. Is that correct?
We did not get the leverage overview memorandum. We have no idea what it is. Mr. Gray contends that the GIF compression techniques letter, there is no version of that letter which says leverage overview memorandum. There is none. We deny that we ever received the gift compression techniques letter. Now, there potentially could be an issue of fact there because Mr. Gray claims that he provided that to us.
His
testimony even on that was equivocal. He says he believes he gave it to Grace Kruger after a February 01 meeting in Tampa. There's no evidence that he did. She denies it.
But it also looks, I mean, I was trying to trace this through on page 11 of your brief. It looks like this gift compression techniques document did come into your hands one way or the other. What I outlined is Gray gives it to Green, who gives it to Elliott, who gives it to Jones, who uses it for NIW. I mean, it seems to me somehow one way or the other someone could conclude that you got Gray's memo.
Potential that Mr. Jones did have the memo and Mr. Elliott probably had the memo. Neither are employees of NIW.
Elliott, they were working for you. They were independent contractors, though. So NIW could have incorporated in its literature, for example, some of these phrases, you know, elegant solutions and the like.
And clearly that happened. But if I could explain, Mr. Elliott is the one who, on his own accord, was also trying to engage in the marketing of this exact concept prior and with no relationship. He decided that he didn't have any short summary of the concept, so he put this executive summary together, which ended up finding its way into the NIW materials, a very small portion of them. Mr. Elliott at that time, so he's the one who wrote it, and that apparently is when it happened. So he was not employed. He was not even a consultant of NIW. He was obviously had relationships with NIW and ultimately provided that to Brian Jones, who was a independent contractor and who did was given the document in order to edit it for purposes of the this marketing materials that NIW was putting together. But fundamentally, what the tax track is attempting to do there's no non-compete, and so there's no reason why NIW couldn't compete with the same exact program after the contract as NIW and Grace Kruger as principal was doing before. The mere fact that Mr. Gray wrote down in this gift compression letter certain elements of the program does not turn the program into the entire concept into his own ownership of him and to prevent anybody from doing it. At most, this case involved the alleged plagiarism of some marketing puffery in this gift compressions letter, which we never even got, which we were never told was a leverage overview memorandum, and which was prepared by a non-employee of NIW. The tax track didn't even bring this up in its original complaint. The first NIW was aware that there was any similarity in the language was in December 01 when tax track filed a motion for a preliminary injunction. NIW read that, they changed it immediately. And it was no admission of liability or anything. It was just, we don't need to use this. This is just marketing puffery. This is just language.
The contract was, able to be terminated upon 90 days' notice? Was that what it was?
That is correct, Your Honor. And on April 4th, 2001, Dane Womwell of NIW sent a notice of termination letter. And in that letter, it is referenced, the 90-day period is referenced, and Judge Gettleman talks about it at, I believe, page 18 of his opinion, and talks about how in that letter, Mr. Womwell points out that we will share commissions on any cases that close, and Mr. Womwell notes none have closed as of yet, but otherwise we're going to be going our separate ways. NIW, of course, was going to be going its separate ways and was had the right to begin preparations.
The contract didn't reference anything that might happen after the contract was terminated, did it?
Absolutely not. No, the there was no non-compete, and in fact, paragraph three specifically contemplates that there would be competition post termination of this contract, and we think that's important. That the notion that Tax Track argues in reply that they are not trying, or did not, or are not now trying to prevent NIW from marketing the concept is simply incorrect. In their motion for preliminary injunction, page 2, they specifically asked Judge Gettleman to bar NIW from marketing the concept of premium-financed life insurance.
Just to be clear, in this article, or maybe there are other places as well, It's your position that premium-financed life insurance with this deferred interest and all the rest of it, all the particulars of this system, every single one of them was in the public domain as a package?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Including the deferral of interest. What we've had the hardest time figuring out is what really it is they claim is the protectable or unique thing about it. After trying to figure it out and talking to a lot of people in the industry, at most it would be the long-term deferral of interest for more than 1 year. And that was the whole reason that we entered into the contract with plaintiff, is because he claimed that he had these lenders willing to do this. That turned out to be false.
Is that really what it boils down to? He's got a list of lenders who will lend for long term, and that's really basically what it amounts to?
He stated he did, but he did not. And that's why the contract was terminated. That's why no cases were closing. At his deposition, he admitted, and this was a year after the termination, that he had never closed a case with this so-called long-term financing, which would, at a minimum, be more than 1 year, which if it's not more than that, and this is the principal and the interest of the loan. Everything is in the public domain. There was testimony from a man named Maurice Engelman, but back in the 1960s, there was deferral of principal and interest. There's an argument about the rider, that Mr. Gray allegedly developed this rider. First of all, that's false. This was WRL's rider. It's a public document filed with the departments of insurance in every state in which WRL did business. There was also testimony that other insurers had similar riders. Moreover, it was Grace Krueger. And the testimony showed, through representatives of WRL long before the contract was entered into, was involved with WRL with formulating this rider. Now, it is true that Mr. Gray was involved in that process, but Ms. Krueger, as far back as July 1999, was actively marketing the same concept with David Green, and Bill Gray was going to share some of the profits from any cases that closed, which they did not. It is just impossible to, as Your Honor pointed out, to retroactively apply this confidentiality agreement to something that the defendant was already doing and others were already doing. The fundamental point and the only issue, because there was no non-compete, the only issue was whether or not somehow something from this gift compression letter would rise to the level of something confidential. We think it's all marketing puffery. Even if it's not, and we think if you look at the reply brief, there's nothing in there beyond marketing puffery. They talk about the rider, they talk about the interest. That's all in the public domain. But as Judge Gettleman focused,
can I just ask you randomly what PS58/Table 38 economic benefit costs are? That's in the reply brief in this comparison of TaxTrack's leveraged overview memo with your executive summary. It's on page 6. And I guess of all the things in this comparison, that struck me as so, whatever it is, very particular. Maybe it's something in the insurance industry that everyone knows about except me. But in the middle box, it says, the elimination of PS58/Table 38 economic benefit costs if a split dollar.
I believe a split-dollar policy has to do with employment-related insurer. I will tell you, I don't believe there was any argument or evidence in the record with respect to that particular paragraph.
Split-dollar has been used widely in some of the Enron and other Conseco cases.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, but also the PS58 Table 38, that...
I will tell you, I don't believe there's
something
any
out there.
I don't believe there's any evidence in the record about that particular phrase. The point and the fundamental point that Judge Gettleman and all he had to get to was the issue of whether or not the gift compression letter had been widely and publicly distributed. And as Judge Sykes pointed out, he did the math, and that was conclusive, and it was very easy. He could have ruled in many other ways, including damages, et cetera. With respect to the issue of attorney's fees, The argument is made that Judge Gettleman should have delayed ruling on that. I don't know any authority that would support that. The case was over We believe that it was rightly decided and that there was no reason to wait to award attorney's fees until after this appeal. The argument that it was a draw is simply false. Judge Gettleman, this is an abuse of discretion standard. Judge Gettleman lived with this case. She had a preliminary injunction hearing where evidence was taken. There were all sorts of discovery disputes. It was a hard-fought case. Ultimately, plaintiff was trying to put defendant out of business. Plaintiff lost. Yes, we lost on our counterclaim, but it was defensive in nature. He was correct. Judge Gettleman was correct with respect to that. If you look at, and I think some good evidence of that, if that's relevant to your honors, is the April 4th, 2001 termination letter that defendant sent to plaintiff. If you look at that letter, there's no threat of a lawsuit. There's no threat of that there's going to be any ongoing dispute. It was the parties were going to go their separate ways. This was a compulsory counterclaim that was filed in response to this, what we believe is an anti-competitive lawsuit, and it was properly disposed of by way of summary judgment by Judge Gettleman. And if your honors have any other questions.
Just a technical question before you sit down. Why was this case venued here? It's my understanding that the plaintiff is a citizen of Minnesota, is that right? And
correct.
Your client, Texas?
There was a choice of law, a choice of forum provision,
is
as I recall,
contract?
In the contract,
okay.
I believe. That's my recollection.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, your honors.
Counsel. Neely, you have a minute to sum up.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to return briefly to the attorney's fees order that was entered and the third point on which we think Judge Gettleman erred. In his order, he applied the prevailing party test to the party that was not seeking attorney's fees. And if you – excuse me, Your Honor – if you look, what he did is he said that he looked to see whether TaxTrack was the prevailing party, determined it wasn't, and then failed to make the same test as against NIW. The district court said that TaxTrack warded off NIW's counterclaim but did not receive any of the benefits sought or relief on the merits. I'd add as an aside that once we brought to their attention by way of our lawsuit that they had plagiarized our documents, they self-censored them. Those documents, and that is a benefit that we achieved, although it wasn't by way of judicial decree. And finally, the suit did not materially alter the party's legal relationship. Let's turn that around and apply the same test to NIW. Yes, NIW warded off TaxTrack's affirmative claim, but it failed to attain any of the relief it sought on its counterclaims. Calling them defensive is convenient, but that would be a bad precedent to set, that the second party to the lawsuit can always avoid the outcome of its litigation just by saying, well, that was defensive, Your Honor. We had to bring those. And here, putting in discovery responses that claimed both itemized damages and general damages in different categories totaling over $1.3 million is simply not defensive. And so when you apply the rule that Judge Gettleman did, the prevailing party rule, to NIW, NIW was not the prevailing party in the case.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.